Welcome to the Shauna Nyquist podcast. Today I'm having a conversation with a dear friend, Henry Cloud. He is an author, a psychologist, a leader, someone that I've known for probably almost 20 years. I think I met him when I was in college, and that was almost 20 years ago. He's been a family friend for a long time. He and his wife, Tori, are sort of like our much-loved extended family, and he's someone that I learn from every time I spend time with him. Today, I asked him to talk a little bit about marriage and about dating. And those are two things that I think he has some views and some ideas and some directives for us that I think are so profoundly helpful. So I can't wait for you to hear the conversation that we share. First, I want to tell you about one of our sponsors. You know that I am an avid bookworm, and that means I love to read books. I love to read physical books. I love to read ebooks. I also love to listen to books. And so our sponsor today is Audible. If you have not yet gotten into listening to books, I totally recommend it. And I think Audible is a fantastic place to start. They've got a great opportunity for us. You can get a free 30-day trial if you sign up today at audible.com/Shauna Nyquist. So if it's something you haven't tried before, you want to give it a shot, audible.com/Shauna Nyquist. And you know, speaking of Henry, if you wanted to start with a couple of his books, he's written a ton, and Audible offers all three of these. These are my three favorite of his, and you can get them on Audible. Boundaries, I mean, that's just like get it today, your life will be better immediately. Necessary Endings. In our culture, we don't talk a lot about the importance of transitions and kind of acknowledging and grieving the loss at the end of something. Necessary Endings is such a good book. And then The Power of the Other is one of his more recent books that I absolutely loved. So you can go to Audible for any of those three and tons of amazing other titles. And if you want to try it, you can try a 30-day trial. You can sign up today, and you just have to go to audible.com/Shauna Nyquist for a free 30-day trial. All right. Good morning. Welcome to another episode of our podcast. This is, I forget which number this one is, so I won't even pretend to know, but I am delighted to introduce you to a very good friend of mine who I'm sure you've read his books. I'm sure you're aware of him, but he is a very dear friend of mine and has been for many years. So please welcome my friend, Henry Cloud. Hi, Henry.
Hey, Shauna. Good to be with you.
In our house, you know this, but because I have a son named Henry, we refer to you as Big Henry, which I'm sure you think is delightful.
Well, I just always tell people that you named him after me. So there you go.
So thank you very much for joining me in this conversation. I would love to focus on, so for those of you who are just new to this conversation, Henry and I have known each other, I think, for almost 20 years. Henry has been a good friend of my dad's for a long time. And then in more recent years, we've gotten to work together a little bit. And I've gotten to spend some really fun time, both work and play, with he and his wife and their family. And so Henry is both an expert in the field as a psychologist and as a writer and as a speaker, but also he's been a really important kind of mentor and advising voice in my life. So his professional world is very big and very impressive, but he's also like on the short list. When I have a question, I want to know what he thinks about it. So one of the things I'm always asking him about is, my husband Aaron and I have been married for almost 16 years, and Henry's been married. Henry, how long have you and Tori been married?
We're 22 years pretty soon.
Congratulations.
How about that?
So I would imagine, and you can correct me if this is not true, but I would imagine that when people talk to you about their marriages, you hear a lot of the same things over and over again, similar challenges, similar problems. Would you say that's true, that there are a couple through lines that most people are asking you about?
Yeah, I'd say that, you know, there's a Bible verse that says, you know, all these struggles are pretty common to all of us. And when you get underneath whatever it is they're talking about, you get to some pretty common themes that just humans struggle with. And I think the difference is, you know, marriages pretty much have the same issues. It's just that some of them don't handle them as well as others do. And sometimes there's just much more hurt that happens in those issues. So I would say they're pretty common.
So if you had to say, what are the top two or three things that either you hear about all the time or that just every marriage eventually will encounter? What are those two or three things?
Well, I would say that one of them is that, and here's one you hear a lot about. One of them is you've got different, you know, let's just call it attachment seeking needs in each of the, you know, each of the two people. Like one person has some sort of, you know, like a higher need for connection than the other. They might be more extroverted, more introverted, or more detached, or whatever it is. But in a lot of relationships where you kind of see a struggle, you'll see somebody wanting more closeness than the other one. And that's a pretty common one.
And when you encounter a couple and they talk with you about that, and I would imagine fairly quickly you identify like, okay, that's what's happening here. Let's say there is a pretty significant mismatch in the like attention seeking needs from one to the other. What advice do you give them moving forward?
Well, I just say, you know, it's the guy's fault, basically. It's
sure. Yep. That's a good way to start.
And then you're 99% right anyway, right? So now, Sean, I think it's early on, I think you have to get the diagnosis right. You know, there, you can hear the same issue, and it's coming from different places a lot of times. You know, sometimes you've got somebody that's really, really seeking, you know, a lot of connection and wanting to be together all the time, this, that, and the other. And that in and of itself might be because they've got some dependency issues and some real fears of being on their own, you know, and some fears of their own freedom and autonomy. And they've never really kind of established an identity and a life apart from their spouse. And so they want that connection really as a defense against facing some independence. On the other hand, it could be a very good desire for connection, and their spouse might be either wounded, and that's hard. They have some fears of intimacy, or maybe they've got some fears of being controlled. So they're always kind of looking for more and more, you know, time away and time apart just to feel like they have some kind of autonomy and separateness on their own. So there, I don't think there's one piece of advice. I think you got to find out why, because different people will give you the same complaint for very, very different reasons. And a lot of times, you know, one of the classic dynamics we see in this is there are a lot of times where you see, particularly in a marriage, where the wife is a little more assertive and the guy's a little more maybe passive around, you know, areas of conflict or stuff like that. What the guy will do is kind of create this false sense of independence by, you know, just diving into work or a hobby or, you know, being on the internet all the time or something. And it's really their own kind of almost passive aggressive way of getting their own space when they really should be able to find that freedom in the relationship and not have to withdraw from the relationship in order to find it.
That is an interesting dynamic that I think most people don't think of, or at least maybe I wouldn't have thought of, that someone chooses to withdraw not because they don't want to be with you or not because they don't want to love you, but because they don't know how to engage what they're feeling about something in the relationship not being right.
Right. And it's a weird paradox, but there's hard to find a greater intimacy builder than the word no. Because, you know, if you can be in a relationship and you're really, really connected and you can disagree, and that doesn't mean a fracture in the connection, or you can say, no, I don't want to do that, or no, I don't think that, or no, I disagree, or no, I don't want to go to that movie. Let's find another one. And if you have that and you can maintain the connection in those differences, that's what makes for fantastic intimacy, when each person feels like they're in control of themselves. But you get one person that's afraid to do that for whatever reason, they're kind of compliant, they're a little bit of a people pleaser, then passively and unconsciously, they're going to be seeking their own independence in a way, their own voice. And in fact, I just had a horrible, horrible thing happen with some friends that they had, you know, great couple. They'd only been married like a few years. And all of a sudden, he just out of the blue said, you know, I don't want to be married anymore. And when you started to, you know, kind of question below the surface of all of it, what he said was, well, I just don't feel like I have a voice in the relationship. And so, okay, well, come home and find your stupid voice. Don't leave the relationship in order to feel like you're free, because that's not going to do it anyway. And so a lot of times, I think, Shauna, that what happens is there's a violation of the created order. You know, if you go back to the book of Genesis, it's just right there. This is what every family systems, every psychology marriage textbook you'll ever read will verify this, exactly what Genesis says, that you've got to leave and cleave. So in other words, if somebody really hasn't left home, if they haven't become an adult apart from their parents, and they get married, then they're going to experience marriage from a child's perspective. And then they're going to have to leave the one they've cleaved to, because they never left and they've never really cleaved. And so there's a lot of stuff to work out sometimes.
Interesting. So it's sometimes not even as much being too close to your family of origin, or sometimes people talk about that when they talk about leaving and cleaving, they talk about, you know, you can't cleave properly if you spend too much time with your family of origin or if you're too close to them. But you're maybe talking about another thing, about going through life as an adult or as a child. And so it might not be about spending time with or not spending time with, but about whether or not you have the skills to encounter a relationship as an adult, or if you only know how to be related to as a child. Is that sort of what you're saying?
Absolutely. It has nothing to do with how much time you spend or don't spend. There are some people that are in the child position in life who live 3,000 miles away from their family, and they still feel controlled by them. And they feel controlled by them, you know, either in opinions or people pleasing with other people or whatever. And there's other people, they may be in a family business and stay with their family for, you know, 30, 40 years. But they're staying with their parents as adults. They've psychologically, they've grown up, and now they have relationships with their parents where when the four of them go out to dinner, there's four adults going out to dinner. But there's other situations like that where they really still are in the child, you know, in the child position. And I always talk about, you know, marriage is about oneness, right? And so if you think about it, marriage is multiplicative. It's not addition, it's multiplication. And what a lot of people do is they never really become an adult in relation to their own parents. They're still worried about what they think, or they still feel controlled, or they're still looking for approval, or, you know, whatever it is, they still have this kind of one down position in life. So they're really not a complete person. They're not a one, they're like a half a person. And then they go marry a half a person to complete them, and they think a half plus a half is going to equal one. Well, marriage is multiplicative, and it's really, you're supposed to take one person, you're supposed to find another complete person, and one times one equals one. And if you multiply a half and a half, you get a fourth. And that's what happens when people haven't established their own independence in their brains and their adults and their patterns and their choices and their values, then they cleave to another half a person, and then you got a half times a half equals a fourth. It diminishes you. And then that's a big, big problem when you're in marriage and you feel like your marriage diminishes you instead of multiplies you.
And I've heard you say similar things, but I don't think I've heard that actual equation before. And that is such a helpful way to think about it. One thing I have heard you say before is that idea that the kind of the healthiest marriages are not some magic, like you magically found the one right person on earth. The healthiest marriages are made of the healthiest individuals, and that a lot of the work in marriage is not just on the quality of the relating pattern, but on the whole healthy person that you're bringing to that relationship.
Yeah, and you know, there's no such thing as a perfect person, but what we've got to do is there really are, though, some fundamental developmental issues that we kind of have to, we sort of have to bring up at least, you know, good enough toolkit in those areas to make a marriage work. Like, you've got to be able to create attachment. You've got to be able to need another person and not have a need-fear dilemma. And so you've got to be able to be open and vulnerable and really come to each other with your needs. That's what builds attachment. But in that attachment, you've got to be able to be free, to have your own boundaries, to say no, to have, you know, like we're sitting here talking and you've got a career of your own and all this kind of work you do. And yet you got a close relationship with Aaron. Y'all are one, but you're separate too. And you have your own life. Sort of like, you know, Proverbs 31, she's out there running a business and doing a bunch of stuff while you're connected. So that those two big issues are big. A third one, though, and this is huge. When people, by the time you get married, you should have come to grips with what's called the integration of the good and the bad. You know, we're born on this earth, and we were designed to be in a perfect state. You know, you're supposed to live in a paradise where your spouse is perfect and you're perfect and all of that. We weren't designed to live with imperfections and sin and mistakes and immaturity and all of that junk. And what happens is a lot of people never have kind of gotten to where they cannot split the world into black and white and good and bad and realize the same person I love and adore and think is the most incredible human on the earth that I gave up all other people for, this one person, that person is also going to hurt me. You know, they're also going to disappoint me. They're also going to make mistakes. And so if we can't accept less than a perfect person and keep them good, and when we make mistakes and you know, can admit those and own those and go through our own failures and not feel like we're all bad and get into that weird dynamic, and the two adults are looking at each other going, you got great parts, you got bad parts, I love all of you, we're going to work with the bad and we're going to adore the good. That's a mature relationship. And then I think that, you know, the next issue is one we referred to earlier, where you've got to have become an adult and you have your own opinions and values and gifts and talents, and you're making something of your life and you're not dependent on your spouse in a sort of like a parental way.
You know, I think going back one second, what you were just talking about in terms of that seeing people as all good and all bad. I remember very early in my marriage to Aaron, I was out to breakfast with a mentor, and I had I said something about, and this is something only someone who's been very newly married would say, but it's something about, I'm so glad that I'm finished with dating. I can stop getting hurt. And she said, whoa. Like, I don't want to burst your beautiful newlywed bubble, but you will find that there is no one who you've ever dated who will have the capacity to hurt you because of the intimacy with which you live. Your days of being hurt are not over. Your days of forgiving are just beginning. Your days of making it right afterward are just beginning. But to kind of disabuse ourselves of that issue that you'll never get hurt in the context of a marriage, I think is really helpful.
It's really, really helpful. And to both come into the relationship with the skills and be building those skills. If you didn't come into it with the skills, be building the skills of resolving and repairing hurt. You know, what all the marriage research will tell us is that the couples that have the best methods of repair, and, you know, reparation is a big deal. And when we've hurt each other or when we failed each other, how we repair those is really, 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 really important. And there's no place where you're not going to be hurt. I think it was C.S. Lewis. It might have been Thomas Merton, but one of them said, there is a place where you can be safe from being hurt by love. And that place is called hell.
Wow.
There's one place.
There's a family in our church, and this is like my favorite story. This married couple was so committed to demonstrating forgiveness to their kids. They so badly wanted their kids to know, sometimes mom and dad fight, but we are so committed to forgiveness, that when they would get in a fight and then they would like yell out to all the kids, like, okay, everybody, we need you in the kitchen. We need you in the kitchen. And they would verbally forgive each other, one and then the other. But their kids, they did it so often and so well and so consistently that after a while, the kids were like, oh, mom, are you going to forgive dad again? It's, you know, oh, dad must be forgiving mom again. But what a great thing to almost get tired of as a child, right? I'm so sick of watching you two honestly repair things together. I think that's such a beautiful image.
Well, it is. It's so good to learn that forgiveness is normalized. It's really good to see modeling of good conflict resolution, good forgiveness, good coming back together, and all of that. I think that sometimes, and you know, it all depends on the ages of the kids and what they can tolerate and metabolize, but that's certainly a good norm to have in any family.
So I want to talk just for a couple of minutes about dating. I feel like
now, if you're married, that really should be something that you just give up. It doesn't work out well, child.
So I want your opinion on whether or not I should start dating.
I think you got to, that's just one of them. You just got to give it up.
One thing that I have appreciated so much with you. So over the last couple of years, we've had a couple meals with friends of ours who are younger, who are single, who have been through maybe recent breakups. I can think of a couple dinners that we've had around the table with your family and mine and some friends. And there is, I think, especially in like Christian culture or the church community, there's so much of like marriage is the end all be all. And dating is just like a rough jungle that you must pass through until you get to the good part. And I have always appreciated that you have such a positive view of dating, of how fun it is, of how much you can learn about yourself, about the world, about other people. I feel like you very frequently are a voice of like, this is fine. You're not over the hill. This life has not passed you by. You are right where you need to be. And dating is a really fun, good endeavor, a good way of living. I love how you do that.
Well, I think it's a big need to talk about. In fact, I got so pumped about this that I actually wrote a book on it. There was a time, this has been probably 10 years ago, I would be out speaking, and it was always women. The three women would walk up to me. I don't know why women come up and ask the speaker a question in groups of three. They go to the bathroom together, they talk to the speaker together. I don't get it. But anyway, they would always come up and say, can we ask you a question? I'd say, sure. And they would say, why aren't we dating? I go, I don't know why you're dating. And they go, well, we want to be dating, but we're not. And they would talk about how in their singles group, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't okay. And you know, dating had this bad connotation and everybody was freaked out about it. And they wanted to be dating, but they weren't. And I kept hearing this over and over. So, Sean, I don't know if you know this or not, but what I did was, I remember where I was in Daytona Beach, Florida. Three women walked up to me and they go, oh, yeah. And they said, why aren't we dating? I said, you know what? I don't know, but I'm going to find out. I'm going to crack the code on it. And so I put together dating groups all over the country. And for a year, I researched this. And my mission was to find out why are single, especially Christians, because they do some weird stuff with weird thinking about the faith and all this kind of stuff that I think really was locking them up in prison. But I started to research this and basically I found out, you know, there are real reasons why somebody that doesn't, you know, want to be necessarily single or they want to be dating, there are reasons they're not. And there are also reasons why the people that are dating are not finding the right one. I mean, this is just very, very diagnosable and workable. So I did all that research. I came up with a plan. I wrote a book called How to Get a Date Worth Keeping. And the reason I called it that was if you're dating, you got one or two problems. Either you're not getting dates, and there's a reason for that, or you're getting dates, but they're not worth keeping around. And so I think it's a big issue. There are real reasons, and I can't tell you, and I want to say, I know it's been hundreds, but it's got to be thousands of between the emails and the letters and people walking up to me. I have couples walk up to me all the time when I'm out there on the road speaking. They'll walk up and they'll flash their rings and say, we got married because of their book. I read your book and I found out I should have been dating in a different way and blah, blah, blah. And so I think we need to tell people this is a great way to learn about life and have a lot of fun.
So what would be a couple things that you would say to, you know, like my friends who are just, let's say, frustrated. What would you say to someone who feels like they're not meeting the kinds of people they want to meet?
Well, first of all, I'd ask them about their traffic patterns and their numbers. You know, you look at a lot of singles and what happens is, you know, you go to school or you go to college. Well, you're in college, you're in a dating farm. I mean, there's a fence around it, right? you're there with however many thousands of singles, all this, all the right demographic, the whole bit. But then you get out of school and you go to work. And then you get into this adult kind of pattern. And you go to work, you go to the same job every day, you see the same six people every day. You come home, you might have a roommate, it's the only person you see. You go to some singles group on Sunday, it's the same bunch of people you've seen for the last 5 or 10 years. You know, Saturdays you run errands. You're not even getting in front of enough people to even make this make sense. And a lot of people just sit back and say, well, God's supposed to bring me, you know, I'm trusting God. That's not how the Bible reads at all. I remember a lady called in on a radio show one day and she said, you shouldn't be telling people about dating. God's going to bring me my husband. And I said, well, do you have to do anything? And she goes, well, I'm trusting the Lord to bring him to me. I said, well, do you have to do anything? And she goes, well, I'm trusting. I go, lady, do you have to go outside? I mean, do you have to leave the house? She goes, I trust the Lord so much. He's going to bring the man I'm supposed to marry to me. And I said, all right, well, if you don't want to marry the FedEx guy or Jehovah's Witness, you better get outside. You've got to think about your active role in this. And sometimes we find that's the problem. Sometimes we find that people have issues. You know, they might be great with their friends and interactive and all this, but they get with a potential date or somebody they might be interested in. And when you watch them, they turn into a different person. You know, there's some kind of anxiety or there's maybe some kind of body image, something or some kind of, you know, whatever it is. And literally the chemistry that attracts all of their friends to them just basically shuts down because they're not the same person when they're in that dyad. And so sometimes there's issues that have to be worked out. And another big issue is, and I would scream this from the rooftops, you've got to get rid of this stupid thing called a type. And there are people that have, well, she's not my type or he's not my type. If you've got a type, that's probably pathologically built. In other words, you've probably chosen that type out of some sort of deficit or some sort of past experience or something, and it's probably compensatory or defensive in nature. And what the biggest step, and I write about this in the book, the first thing you got to get people to do is about marriage, okay? You're not out on a safari looking for the trophy. Dating is about learning. It's about experiencing a lot of different kinds of people. It's learning about yourself. It's learning what you like and what you don't like. And you know what? If they're safe, you're not going to get hurt, or they're not dangerous, I say go out with anybody once. Because why wouldn't you enjoy sitting down to lunch or dinner and just getting to know another person and finding out what they're like and listening and all that? And just give up this type thing. I can't tell you how many people I've heard say, when I gave up my type and just started going with all kinds of different people, I found out there were other types that I actually liked better. And they opened themselves up to a lot of different kinds of people and they learned and they grew.
I love that. And you know, that phrase that you used a couple minutes ago when you talked about someone having to up their numbers. So I remember you talking about that at our church. And then a group of girlfriends who get together every week. One of them is single, and they were talking about their goals for the year. And she said, you know what, girls, I'm telling you right now, I'm saying it out loud, I'm going to up my numbers. And so they were out one night and a guy came over to them and said, hey, I think maybe we went to high school together. And she said, oh, you know, that's nice. And then he walked away and the whole group of girls looked at her and they were like, that's it? And she was like, you're right. I have to go up my numbers, don't I? And she walked over to the table. She walked back over to him and said, you know, I heard you say you're back in town after being away for a while. Maybe we could go out for coffee. And that couple is one of the happiest couples I've in anywhere in my life right now, because she said, I'm going to take responsibility for changing, like you say, the traffic patterns. I'm going to invite more people into my life and see where that goes. Other podcast sponsor today is Cladwell. If you're anything like me, you totally know that feeling of having a closet, or in my case, a floor full of clothes, and you still feel like you have nothing to wear. And they say that actually, most of us only wear 20% of our wardrobe. I think it's probably even lower than that for me. Cladwell is a really cool company, and they're on a mission to help us look our best, save time, and live simply. So how it works is every morning you get an outfit recommendation from the clothing that you own and the weather in your location, so you can get rid of that, like, oh my goodness, I hate everything I own, closet meltdown. With each passing day, you get kind of more insight into what you wear and what you don't, so you can get rid of clutter and have a simple closet that you actually love. So if this sounds like something that would be helpful for you, I know it is for me, I want you to check out their app and their mission at cladwell.com/Shauna. There's a set of questions that I ask every guest.
Are they hard?
They're super hard. And I'm actually going to tally them and then give you a percentage at the end with a grade letter. Does that feel okay?
Okay. Well, if, this is when I want to be a millennial. Can I just get a trophy for showing up? Yeah.
I promise. These are softball questions. You can get these.
All right.
So, and there's no wrong answer. Well, maybe there is. Maybe I'll tell you afterwards if you have a wrong answer, but I think you can do this. So the first question is just about a spiritual practice. What's one spiritual practice of any kind that's helping you or healing you in your life right now?
Right now?
Yeah.
Just one?
Just one.
Sharing my faith with Uber drivers.
Tell me about that.
Well, yeah, I'm having more fun. B, I'm really seeing things happen. But C, it's really helping me just grow into another dimension of just watching God, how real God is and when he shows up, and just watching him work. But it's been something I've been doing for a while now, and it's continuing, you know, to grow. I've prayed with people for healing. I've prayed about their finances. I've prayed with Uber drivers to meet Jesus. It's the one right now, that one of the ones that's really most driving a lot of spiritual energy for me.
I love that. There's another podcast guest that I had recently, and she said a similar-ish thing, kind of saying that, talking about how much her faith grows and is kind of challenged and shaped as she talks about her faith and invites other people into that conversation.
Yeah, Sean, I got to tell you one quick story. I hope I can make this quick. So one morning I was in Florida. I'd been speaking at the thing, and I was leaving early one morning, and I just felt so strongly that I was supposed to tell somebody that day about Jesus. And I'm going, okay, God, I'm available. Use me. I don't know where it is. So the car comes and picks me up. I think it's the driver. I start telling the driver. The driver's got a strong faith. I'm going, well, that's not him. You know, so I keep looking. I get on the plane, and I sit down, and across the aisle from me is this guy that I just know, because I live in L.A., and you just learn when you're around a celebrity. I mean, they just have this, they smell different. I mean, I don't know how to explain it. They carry them. They're on a plane. They're kind of, I always kind of hide a little bit. I could just tell. I didn't know who he was. Didn't know what movies he was in. Didn't know anything like that. But I knew he was somebody. And so I started thinking, you know, well, maybe God, you know, and I'm just asking, is this person I'm supposed to talk to? So about that time, people start filing in that all look like rock stars. And they, you know, are high-fiving him as they go by. And I'm starting to figure this out, that this guy's the rock star, and that's probably the band or the roadies or whatever. And they're you know, heading back to their seats and saying hi. So one of them walks by him, and when he does, this guy, the rock star, holds up this book. And he says, okay, I'm reading it. And the other guy goes, great, tell me how you like it. And I looked at the book. And it was Tim Keller's Reason for God or something. I don't exactly know the title.
Yeah, I think that's it.
And so I thought, maybe this is it. And so I leaned over and I said, so is that a good book? And he leans over and he goes, oh yeah. He said, I've been reading it. He goes, I'm just like, I'm in this place, man. He said, I've been down the last month. I've been like really, really depressed. And he said, I was doing some drugs and he goes into this whole thing about this dark depression and these obsessional fears and trying to find God and all this. And all of a sudden, he goes, we're sitting there on the tarmac. He's pulling all this out. All of a sudden, he looks at me and goes, wait a minute. Why am I talking to you? What do you know about, like, psychological problems or God? He said, do you know anything about that stuff? And I go, well, a little bit, you know. And he said, well, come sit over here. And he asked the guy next to him to change seats. So for all those hours flying back across the country, he starts telling me about his search for God and what he's going through. And then he says, I said, was that book helping you? And then he goes, well, actually, there's another book that I'm connecting with more. And I said, well, tell me about it. So he starts to describe it. And I go, that book sounds really familiar. He says, well, here it is. He pulls it out. And it's a book by John Ortberg, Soul Care, maybe?
Soul Keeping, maybe.
And I wrote the foreword to that book. My name's on the cover. And I said, oh, yeah, I do know that book. And we started talking. He goes, wait a minute. And that just opened further doors of him trusting, you know, to talk about this. And so we spent the whole time. We got to be friends. He came to Beverly Hills. We had lunch, you know, a few times. Then we got together as couples, and we still do. And we're on a, you know, he's on a path with God now. And it's just one of the most fun spiritual practices that I'm into right now.
I love that. And essentially it's two practices, right? It's listening for kind of God's, the whisper of his spirit or the nudge of his spirit. And then it's being open to conversations about faith everywhere we go. I love that. I think that's a really beautiful way to live.
I know, it's really, and it turns out the guy's a huge rock star. My daughters were like freaked out that he was at our house.
That's a fun bonus whenever you can impress your teenage daughters.
Yeah. It doesn't happen often, I promise you.
Okay, so I want to talk about books just for a minute. Do you have an all-time number one favorite book?
Yeah, but you're going to laugh.
I promise not to laugh.
I would say this because it was a book that truly changed my life. It's called Ego Psychology 1 by Gertrude and Ruben Blanc.
Okay, and tell us why. Was it... Did you first read it as a course, like in college, or?
No, I read it after my first year of graduate school, and it brought everything that I had ever wondered about God and faith. It's not a Christian book. It comes out of psychoanalysis, but it really talked about character structure and how the equipment works in a human, of how we work through and have these developmental injuries and all this kind of stuff. It glued it all together in a way that I never had seen it before. And all the different schools of psychology, all of a sudden, they all started to make sense, that they all had a piece, but they didn't have the whole. And the way that it integrated in terms of the image of God, who we're created to be, and how we get broken and how we get healed. I just say that's the book. But I'll tell you a couple of other ones that would be in that. Now, you know, obviously my favorite book is the Bible. I read that one more than any. But another one would be No Man Is an Island by Thomas Merton.
Yeah.
That was a really important one to me. And another one was The Divided Self by R.D. Lang.
Okay. I think you are not the first person to mention Merton on this podcast. That his name comes up over and over again. Are there any books that you give out or recommend to people over and over again?
Yeah. Now, it's going to sound weird because one of them is mine.
Well, that makes sense to me. I give out your books like crazy. So is there one?
There is Necessary Endings.
Yes.
Because people talk about these situations all the time, and that's what Necessary Endings is about. They've got some situation, you know, in work or in their personal life where, you know, it's time to make a hard ending, and it's hard to do that.
I think, obviously, I reread your book, Boundaries, probably more often than most. Like, that's one of my go-tos, especially when I can tell that I'm not practicing great boundaries. So that's when I come back to over and over again. But both Necessary Endings and The Power of the Other really stuck with me, both of those.
Well, it's, you know, it's, they're tough issues, right?
They are. And I think you're right that we live in a culture that doesn't, we talk a lot about starting things, right? The beginnings of things, of relationships, of businesses, of all kinds of things, but we don't talk about how to let go of things very well. And so I think Necessary Endings is really helpful. It was helpful for me, helpful for a lot of people in my life.
It's something we go through over and over and over. You know, Ecclesiastes 3 says there's beginnings and endings. You know, there's a time to embrace. There's certain relationships that, you know, there was a time to be deeply involved in that friendship or that circle of friends or whatever. But then it says there's a time to shun embracing. It's a time where, you know, it's a different season. There's a time to plant, a time to uproot what you've planted. And it's an incredible chapter in Ecclesiastes about beginnings and endings. And we often don't see that.
I want to switch to another topic that I know is close to both of our hearts, which is eating and time around the table.
Now we're talking.
I know. Some of my favorite times with you have been times when our families have been around the table. So I know this is going to be a fun part of the conversation. If you knew that it was your last supper, where would it be? Who would be there? And what would you eat?
My last meal. Now I'm on death row. Is that what happened?
No. Some people, no, you're not on death row. You just existentially somehow know. Okay. Like you have a sense. This is it.
Yeah, this
and
is it.
You okay. Get to create.
Where would it be?
Where would it be?
It would be on Eagle Lake in Mississippi. It's a lake, where our family had a lake house and, that's where it would be. I'd be sitting out on the lawn overlooking the lake with my friends and family, and that's who I'd be with, and that's where I'd be.
And what would you eat?
I would eat so much that they'd have to bring it in on trucks. Okay, so I would really be torn here. It'd be one of two things. It would probably be my favorite Southern food. So, let's say fried chicken, turnip greens, black-eyed peas, fried okra, biscuits, white rice with brown gravy, just all of this, you know, the Southern stuff, boiled cabbage, all of that. I would just surround myself with mountains of it. Or my favorite dish in the whole world is... I love Italian, and it would be a seafood pasta with a white wine olive oil sauce and some flaky red peppers.
Oh, that sounds, both of those sound delicious.
A really, really, really good, earthy, dusty, dry red wine.
Yes, absolutely. I feel great about those choices. Okay, so what are, if I were to go into your home right now, if I was in the cloud kitchen, if I went to either your fridge or your pantry, what would be things that would always be there? Five things that will always be in your house.
For me or the clouds?
Well, just for you.
Oh, because that's a very, very, very different list.
I'm sure that is. You can throw in a couple of theirs if you want to.
I live with three very healthy women. So I'll give you my list. Five things that are always going
to
be there?
Yeah, up to five.
Dill pickles.
Mm-hmm.
Red wine.
Mm-hmm.
Popcorn.
Okay.
Milk.
All right.
Probably sour gummies.
Interesting. Sour gummies. I did not know that about you.
Yep.
I overheard over the holiday weekend, I overheard my my 5-year-old, telling a group of people that he had just met that some people are pickle people and some people are not pickle people. And his mom is a pickle person.
Yay.
So that's something we have in common. I would always have dill pickles in my house. Is there, tell me about one either food or flavor that represents a happy or rich memory for you.
Oh, gosh. It would be, you know, it's that whole pile of stuff, mustard greens, cornbread, butter beans, black-eyed peas. When I, that that food just, it represents so much. I grew up in the South. I grew up in Mississippi, and so much, you know, family and Southern and the Allman Brothers and everything about the South. It just every time I have that food, I'm just happy.
I love it. That's great. Well, that's a perfect note to end on. Henry, thank you so much. I know you're so busy. I know you're in the middle of a busy week right now. It is such a gift to me that you were willing to spend this time with me. So thank you.
Oh, Shauna, I tell people to read your books all the time, and we get to work on some projects together. In fact, I need to talk to you because I've got another one that I want you to work with me on. So we'll have to talk.
Oh, let's do it. That sounds great. Thank you for being here, and I'll talk with you soon.
Okay. Say hi to everybody.
I will. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the Shauna Nyquist podcast. If you like what you heard, be sure to subscribe and leave us a review on iTunes. And for more Relevant Podcast Network shows, check out the podcast section at relevantmagazine.com.